very pleased this morning in our convocation to have the most unusual and most distinguished guest with us. First of all, let me say we're also quite happy to have with us this morning a number of guests. A number of guests from some of our academic institutions in the area, and also the Intersynodical Pastoral Conference's meeting on campus this morning. By all means, a welcome to each and all of you. This morning, in our convocation, our guest speaker, Dr. Gerald Brower. Dr. Brower is Dean of the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. His formal training, so forth, this is an ordained Lutheran minister who is taught on the faculty of Union Theological Seminary in New York, the Federated Faculty at Chicago, and for several years now has been Dean of the Divinity School. Dean Brower has also been, and particularly in terms of this morning's address, at the Vatican Council sessions in Rome. And this will be the subject of his address this morning. Dean Brower, if you would, please.
Professor Sommerfeld, I should like to express my gratitude at the opportunity of being here to address this assembly on the issue of the Vatican Council. I've tried for some time to make arrangements, find it possible to visit this campus, and I must say up to this moment, though I've only had about an hour to look around, I am not only not disappointed, but quite thrilled with the beauty of the campus. It's a difficult thing to decide what to say in approximately 35 or 40 minutes about the third session of the Vatican Council. So much has been written by so many observers and non-observers that one is always in danger of simply repeating what you have already heard or read. Nevertheless, anybody who participates in a movement as complex and as exciting as the Vatican Council is bound to have certain observations of his own, for whatever they might be worth. I suppose one of the most intriguing things for all of us present was trying to figure out exactly what was going on at all times. Who is on first? And how did somebody get to third? And when will a run be scored, if at all? We were in sort of an ecclesiastical cloak and dagger atmosphere constantly. And I must say that for myself, this only added to the allure and the excitement. Now, I should like to begin my brief comments by first expressing a few words concerning my own, shall we say, reaction to the setting. To meet each morning from 9 o'clock till 12:30 in the magnificence of St. Peter's is in itself quite an experience. That is, St. Peter's in itself is quite an experience. But when you add to this the fact of the presence of between 2,000 and 2,400 church fathers, plus numerous pariti, that is, the accompanying scholars of the bishops, the observers and guests of various types from various places, this in itself is not easily to be discounted because it is part of the context in which one makes his judgment. Furthermore, the fact that the meetings occurred in Rome, in the city of Rome, cannot be overlooked, at least by a Protestant observer. It might be possible for Catholic participants or observers who are in a sense used to this, though I am positive after being there that even they never really get used to this. For anybody with a sense of Western history, being in Rome is itself an unforgettable experience. Now, my own case, this was complicated by the fact that it was my first trip to Rome. I'd been to Europe on numerous occasions, but never had an opportunity, and by this I suppose I'm saying never had the responsibility of doing anything at Rome, and therefore never went to Rome before. I guess time always prevented it. But now I'm happy that I had never been there before, because I'm convinced unless one can be there for 4 or 5 weeks at a minimum, he shouldn't go. The experience was somewhat along these lines. For better or for worse, Rome is the navel of Western culture. It's sort of the very center. Now, I don't want to make a pun about a naval observatory either. You see, I got as close as I could, though. But it is in a very unique way the birthplace of Western culture, to be sure. We all owe a good deal to Greece, to Athens, and to Jerusalem, but the synthesis, after all, did occur in Rome. And I was struck by the fact that the very location of the center of Roman Catholicism in Rome contributes something unique to its spirit and to its outlook. You cannot help but feel the presence of history as you walk through the streets of Rome, this rare combination of the modern and the ancient. And then, as I say, to attend this in St. Peter's with a sense of continuity. Incidentally, I spent about 3 or 4 hours one afternoon in the archaeological diggings under St. Peter's, most exciting, unusual experience. I had read Kuhlmann's Peter many years ago, and though he had convinced me in that particular volume that whatever else one might say one way or the other, so far as one can depend upon archaeological evidence, this does appear to be the tomb of Peter. And you're also familiar with Kuhlmann's further argument that does not necessarily have certain ecclesiological implications. But the fact remains, one cannot but be impressed with this reality, this sense of continuity, this sense of history. I suppose that this carried over for a Protestant observer, that this is one of the truly good sides to Roman Catholic life, structure, that impresses Protestants, certainly impressed this Protestant. Furthermore, I think I was impressed at Rome by being immersed for a period of 6 weeks in the day-to-day life of the council, which centered very much around the expression of piety, of spiritual life that marks Roman Catholicism. I suppose I can say, not in jest, that I attended more masses in my 6 weeks there than I probably had in my entire life, though I've been at a number of masses in the past. To be at one or either two every morning in the week, this sort of has a cumulative process, you know. And I must say, though I had always sought to understand the nature of the piety of my Roman Catholic friends, particularly theological friends, theologians, priests, again, this had sort of a cumulative result. Seeing this morning after morning, participating in this large number of masses, I grew once again to realize what I once thought was so when I was a young theological student, that to a very unique degree, the center and the power of Roman Catholicism is still to be found in the Mass and in the spiritual life as it is formed in both its priests and its laity. Frequently, you know, we as Protestants, particularly we as theological professors, tend to overlook this. So it was a good, healthy reminder. Now, so much for this general setting in which I found myself and which, in a way, set the stage for my own experience. Now I should like to make a few comments about our reception as observers. Much has been said and written about this, but until you experience it, you really don't understand it. The Protestant observers and the Orthodox observers were truly there as brethren. This was no psychological trick. They're not trying to take us in. We were there because supposedly we had something to contribute. And we were asked to make known our opinions and our ideas, both to individual theologians and bishops, and even by writing to particular commissions. And we did all this. And the spirit with which we were accepted the warmth of acceptance, the concern expressed, went way beyond the simple formalities, so let me assure you that every single amenity was more than covered, but it went way beyond that. It included countless discussions. Almost every evening was spent in theological discussion with a group of Roman Catholic clergy, professors, or both. Now, it was the spirit of our acceptance as observers that perhaps did as much as anything to indicate to us why we were there. And I must say that for those of us who participated in this, we had a sense of freedom in saying exactly what we wanted to say, and in almost all contexts. That is, we were expected to speak as Protestants. We did not have to hide our concern on certain issues, but rather this was requested. And I think one cannot emphasize that too strongly, because how frequently I've heard it said, well, really, we're only invited there, not hear this by observers, but by friends of mine, by other Protestants, we're really only invited there in order to be flattered or to be taken in, quote unquote. Now, there is no denying the fact that from the Roman Catholic point of view, the concern is ultimately the church shall be one in the church as they conceive it to be. One should not expect it to be otherwise. Likewise, there is no denying the fact, from the Protestant point of view, there are indeed profound difficulties to this view of ecclesiology. But that Christ wishes his church to be one, with this we do stand at one with our Roman Catholic brethren. And perhaps it is this bedrock of our unity in the Christ that makes it possible for Rome to extend the call to Protestants to be present at all. Now, let me speak about my own reaction to the council itself, its proceedings, some of the issues, some of the things that developed. First of all, I must plead guilty to the fact that I tended to see everything at the council from primarily one point of view or perspective. Now, it is clear to me, both in reading the literature before going to the council and on arriving there, that most Americans tended to see the importance of the council revolve around two basic issues. One, the issue of religious liberty. The other, the issue and the statement concerning the Jews. This is certainly true of the American public, whether Roman Catholic or Protestant, and especially of the non-religious American public. But I think it is equally true of the religious public. Now, this makes sense, because if you pause for a moment to think about the uniqueness or the peculiarity of Christians in the American context, it does very quickly come down to these two issues. Because it was in the American scene that religious liberty, as such, was first officially achieved under the separation of church and state, and the whole history of our nation is laced through with the consequences of this point of view. And I think one of the things that our Roman Catholic brethren have learned in this context is that for them, as they see the church, its calling, its task, its role, it can actually function better under such a context than any other. Furthermore, I think what we have come to understand in the American context, if we wish liberty for ourselves to pursue what we believe to be the truth in society, in culture, in the totality of our life, then we cannot deny that same possibility to others. For example, it is a little bit difficult, however one argues, on whatever basis, to ask for freedom for the truth, even though we say it is the total truth in our own context, for ourselves, but to deny it to others, and yet at the same time to call for it in certain other places, particularly behind the Iron Curtain. That is, it is difficult to understand how the church can call for freedom to be the church, to carry on its life behind the Iron Curtain, when it denies that same right to others in its own sphere. This is one of the bitter lessons that Christianity is learning in the modern world. So for Americans in particular, this has long been a key issue. It is the context in which the church has carried on her work in America since the founding of the nation. Thus, it's only natural that we should be deeply interested in this. Furthermore, as you know, rightly or wrongly, an awful lot of Americans are still suspicious as to whether their Roman Catholic brethren in the American context really stand for religious liberty in principle. Now, I do not happen to be one of those people who think they have to prove this, but there are an awful lot of Americans who think this way. And therefore, it again is an acute issue for our Roman Catholic brethren as they confront the Vatican Council and its various discussions and decrees. Furthermore, the question about the Jews, I think, is especially important for Americans. That isn't to say that it's not equally important for Europeans, but in some respects, the Europeans have solved the question of their relationship to the Jews by eliminating the Jews and leaving themselves with a very, very uneasy conscience, or it certainly should leave them with that. But again, in the American context, it has been possible for Christians to learn to live with their Jewish brethren, even, praise God, appreciate them for many of their contributions to life, both religiously and culturally speaking. If I might be quite concrete, I would hate to think what American cultural life would be like in music, the arts, science, without the presence of our Jewish brethren. To say anything about the whole religious question with their profound sense of justice. Be that as it may, this too has been and remains a key issue for all Americans. Now, I must admit that from my point of view, I did not go to Rome nor expect these two issues to be the central issues, and I don't think they were or are. I think the central issue is the issue of ecclesiology. And therefore, the whole schema de ecclesia on the church was the central document. I would predict it is the central document of Vatican II. And that therefore all the arguments that swirled in and around and under this particular schema are to be understood as the central problem of the council, and even what happened on religious liberty and the statement on the Jews has to be understood in the context of what is stated concerning the church. Now, why is this the case? Well, first of all, the central concern of Vatican II is the renewal of the church. And there are many, many aspects to the renewal of the church. Religious liberty, the Jews, the church in the world, marriage and family, birth control, dozens of issues. But the central issue is itself the nature, structure, and form of the church. Now, if Vatican I had as its central problem the definition of the role and the power of the papacy, then certainly Vatican II has as its central problem the definition of the role and the power of the bishops, along with, and in some sense under, the Pope. Now, I trust that all of you, as pre-theological students, will set to work and carefully study the schema promulgated on the church, because it will show you, on the one hand, the renewed concept of the church that is underway within Roman Catholicism, and on the other hand, the possibilities of its relationship to its separated brethren, granted its stance on the church. The central issue, I think, is located in chapter 22, the whole problem of the role of the bishop, collegiality. Now, the Roman Church did not arrive at this concept of collegiality overnight, nor with particular ease. It took a good deal of discussion, and in fact, I would go so far as to argue that its full implications will take a long time to be seen, understood, and embodied in the life of the church. But anybody who knows history the history of the Christian Church, the history of Roman Catholicism, should not at all be shocked at this. I think perhaps one of the major things we must understand as we look at the Vatican Council is that the dynamics and the pace of renewal and reform within the Roman Catholic Church have to be true to its own nature. We cannot expect it to reform as a Protestant church or churches do. Nor should we expect it to come out looking more Protestant or less Protestant. I think rather we have to take it in its terms and then look at it and see where it has moved from what point to what point and how rapidly it has done that. Now I must say from this perspective, if you look at the document on the church as it has been promulgated, as over against where the Roman Catholic Church was just 10 years ago, you are amazed at the speed of movement that has occurred. Its own new grasp of its own nature, much more Catholic today than it was 10 years ago. Now, I think my Roman Catholic friends understand what I mean when I say more Catholic today than it was 10 years ago. I think the Roman Catholic Church has begun to face up to the fact that it was in danger of becoming less and less Catholic as the Church moved on into the midst of the 20th century. That is, less universal. In fact, one of the things that strikes you, and I think this is in the center of its renewal, that the Church, which does in a very profound sense represent the most universal segment of the Christian Church, is at the same time in government the most nationalistic. And this is the problem with the Curia. And I suppose we as Protestants can sort of stand aside and scratch our heads and say, is this not peculiar? That the Church, which is in fact most Catholic and universal, is at the same time in its government most nationalistic. May I illustrate? And the discussion and the debates concerning religious liberty or the statement in the Jews, frequently in the foreground was the problem, if we take this action at this time, it will endanger the elections in Italy. Now this must be a very difficult thing for our Roman Catholic brethren and even for the Roman Catholic Church as it seeks to express its universality. And the fact is it took steps in De Ecclesia, De Ecumenismo, that express its nature in a much more truly Catholic form than perhaps had been true for some time. Now one could argue this is nothing new in Roman Catholicism, that is true, but to hold one thing in theory and to actualize it in history are two quite different things. So as you look at the statement on collegiality, the thing that strikes me is this. The Roman Catholic Church is engaged in the effort now to understand the proper function and role of the bishops as ruling bishops along with the Pope. Now, as I heard the debates and as I talked with friends in Rome, I was first of all struck by the fact that there was an extreme conservative wing quite vocal on its opposition to the statement on collegiality as it was finally promulgated. Bishop Staffa was the leader of this group, and I was shocked to hear a Roman Catholic bishop, theologian, argue that the right, the power, and the function of the bishops, that these things were derived from the Pope, from Peter. Well, this is contrary to all Roman Catholic history. And of course, the vast majority of the fathers disagreed with this exceedingly conservative point of view. But it was voiced in the council floor. This position was fought for. Well, I don't care if you look at Bible or tradition. Look at either one in Roman Catholic history, from Roman Catholic eyes. I do not see how such a position can be maintained, as Roman Catholic theologians argued. The right, the role, the function of the bishops was derived from the apostles directly, just as, supposedly, the right, role, and function of the Pope was derived from St. Peter. And that, therefore, what you have is a collegiality of Peter and the bishop and the apostles, the Pope and the bishops. Now the problem for Roman Catholicism, as I see it, is to redress the balance which had, shall we say, gone out of balance from approximately 1870 to 1960, that with the making clear the power, function, and role of the Pope in the government of the Church, in making this clear, the role, function, and power of the bishop was either undercut or not properly understood, or at least out of balance. Now this is again established in theory. This still has to be actualized. Now how will it be actualized? We do not know. First of all, some kind of an adequate form has to be found for it. As long as the council is meeting, the form is present, because there the bishops have an opportunity to express their views as ruling fathers in the Church on the various doctrinal matters, the various moral matters, the issues that the Church confronts as it seeks renewal. And they're doing this every day. Before the present chapter could be adopted in De Ecclesia, in addition to the usual modi, the modifications that were brought in out of the Theological Commission, in the case of De Ecclesia, an explanation, expletiva, had to be produced. Well, I must say, the wording of this is a work of sheer genius, because the wording is so broad that it got everybody under the tent. Conservatives, moderates, progressives, whatever terminology you want to use. So that when the final vote was taken on this particular chapter and on the entire schema, I forget the exact count, but out of about 2,200 bishops, I think it was only a handful that voted either juxta moda, which they weren't supposed to vote, and I believe there's only one or two negativa votes. But whatever the final count, it was an infinitesimal proportion of the fathers that finally did not vote placet and ecclesia because of the explanation that was appended. Now, some of the progressives were deeply concerned and worried about this explanation, because they said, to be sure, it does not undercut in itself the document on De Ecclesia, but on the other hand, it does leave the door open to a much more conservative interpretation of De Ecclesia than the fathers really want. But then somebody reminded them that in Christian history, the expletivas and even the modi finally have a tendency to disappear in the wings. And what remains in the foreground is itself the statement in the schema. And that is the battle that was won. So as I see the picture, it looks something like this. The principle of collegiality has been adopted. How it will finally work out remains to be seen. Will the Pope set up some kind of a special commission of bishops drawn from different national districts? Will the Curia continue to really rule the Church along with the Pope? Will it be superseded, surrounded, undercut? All of these questions have to be determined yet. If one looks at this historically, and I do not see how the Roman Church can avoid looking at it historically, because it does have a profound historical consciousness, it will soon recognize the fact that just as the Curia came into being at a certain moment in history to perform a certain task, that today, with jet planes, modern transportation, Telstar, the function of the Curia is no longer needed in the way it once was, and there's nothing divine about its origin or its continuation. And therefore, I think historically it is quite possible for the Roman Church to come up with a form that will be an adequate expression of the role of the bishops in the life of the Church, but that still has to come. It is at this point that I should like to make my brief remarks concerning those fateful 48 hours, the last 2 days of the Council, when so many things occurred that it was very difficult to sort out exactly what was happening and what the consequences were. As I see it, the challenge facing Paul VI, incidentally, I think he has the possibility of a great pontificate, quite different from John, but the possibility is there if he will actualize it. Now, nobody knows. For me, he still remains an enigma. I do not believe that in the last 2 days he delivered himself over to the conservatives, as so many people have said. I think he tends to be progressive in temperament and spirit. And might I say, be very careful when you use terms like this, because They are at best shorthand terms. I heard Cardinal Meyer say that when he first went to the council, he thought of himself, and he says he thought most American bishops figured they were, if you wanted to use the term, conservative. But as they were caught up into the day-to-day work of the council and debated in the issues and saw the direction and the press for renewal, they found themselves siding more and more with that beginning handful of men such as Bea and Sunens, Leger, Döpfner, men who were really pressing for renewal in the life of the church. And the reason so many of the bishops have moved in this direction, I think, is completely apart from dogmatic or doctrinal considerations. They express rather the concern of bishops who are charged with the sacred responsibility of the oversight of the spiritual lives of their flock. And when they recognize the problems they face in ministering adequately to their people, they inevitably see the necessity for renewal, even for the overhaul in certain structures and forms in the life of the church. So, said Meyer, we suddenly found ourselves being called progressives, and he said, for heaven's sakes, the other day I picked up a French newspaper, and here is my picture, and it spoke about the leadership of this great liberal. He says, for heaven's sakes, I'm not a liberal. It's just his way of saying the dynamics of the council itself have brought it to the point where the vast majority of the fathers appear to be progressive, if by this you mean deeply enmeshed in the move for renewal and reform. Well, isn't this just a very practical way of saying that the Holy Spirit has a strange way of working his will in the life of the Christian community, above and beyond that of all Christians, including even bishops and popes? I suppose John the 23rd saw that very clearly when he called for the council, not knowing where it would go, and saying, oh, well, let God worry about that. And thus, I should like to say that for me, the question of ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church, is inevitably bound to what happened on religious liberty and the statement on the Jews. Now, obviously, I do not have time to go into this in detail. Thank goodness we have plenty of more time today when we can discuss informally and in other contexts. Here, I should only like to make the following observations. That first of all, I do not believe it is necessary to interpret the Pope's actions on three specific occasions in the last 48 hours as delivering him into the hands of the conservatives. These three actions are, first of all, the blocking of the vote on an initial text of religious liberty, not the final vote, but just the blocking of a text. Secondly, the action with regard to the 19 amendations on De Ecumenismo. And thirdly, the proclamation Saturday afternoon in a special liturgical setting of the Virgin Mary as Mother of the Church. All three of these actions have been taken by a good deal of the press and by many theologians to indicate that Paul VI was wavering and was either backing down in the face of conservative pressure or unwilling to move ahead. My own interpretation runs something like this. In all three cases, I think Paul showed himself to be what he is shaping up to be, essentially a diplomat who does not wish to move unless he carries the vast majority of the fathers with him, and he has in each case thus far, who does think it is both necessary and possible to adopt religious liberty, and is positive this will happen next year, and a good strong statement, but wanted more time in order to carry through the same kind of a majority as was carried in the case of De Ecumenismo and De Ecclesia. And then another dimension to this, we often overlook the fact that bishops, archbishops, cardinals, and popes are human. However much divine guidance they are supposed to receive, they remain human. No man, even a saint, is ever fully an instrument of the divine. Now, perhaps we Protestants stress this more fully and more completely than do our Catholic brethren because of the centrality for us of the doctrine of simul justus et peccator. But the fact remains, Paul VI is still a man. And I think he senses that he has entered a long corridor of history. He cannot turn back. John was correct. The church has entered a new direction. Nobody knows where it will finally go. But it certainly will be different in many respects
from what it has been in the immediate past. I do not think that Paul is the kind of a man who is going to run pell-mell down that corridor. He's going to move slowly. He has the sense of being the successor of Peter. He sits in a very, very responsible post. And therefore, he's going to move with great caution. And might I add that his trips present him here with both an opportunity and a danger. On the one hand, these trips, and I'm sure, by the way, that there will be more, perhaps one major trip before the council reconvenes in September. I'm guessing that. Let's see if I'll be right. We don't know, but I have a hunch that between now and next September, there may be one more major trip coming up. It's an opportunity in that it presents the Pope with the possibility of learning firsthand certain things about this modern world that no man, however open, can discover sitting in Italy. Now, I say this because it's true of any of us. I mean, however sensitive and open we are by reading, by being briefed, that's fine, that's one thing. But to take a sensitive man and let him see with his own eyes and hear with his own ears, and his own total bodily presence to take in an experience, I think is much more profound and meaningful than all the briefing that one can receive. I wonder, for example, what the results of the Pope's visit will really be. To experience at first hand the poverty, the dire poverty, suffering, and misery of this terribly overcrowded, overpopulated place. We do not know, but Paul is a sensitive man. Therefore, his trips are very good, but on the other hand, they're a danger. Because you see, each one of these trips focuses his world attention on his function, on his action, and it is good, it brings a claim, and it ought to, but it could also become the means of avoiding the issue of actualizing collegiality. That is, by turning the attention of the church and of the world to these things, you do not have to face up to certain other things. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm saying this is an implicit danger. Thus, the Pope who takes naturally to this type of thing might even conceive his pontificate along these lines, could use this as a means of strengthening the outreach of the church and even use it as a means of discovering a proper means for collegiality, or it could become the means of avoiding the central issue. Paul has yet to face the central issue. How do you structure, how do you form, historically, ecclesiology? This will not be done simply by the proclamation of De Ecclesia. That is simply the bedrock statement. Now it must be actualized in history. He missed on his first opportunity. And the first opportunity, I think, was the debate on religious liberty and the maneuverings within the council. Well, now, in order that we can have further discussion, this is sort of like ending at the point where you say, tune in at 3:30 or whatever it is, and hear installment two. But I see my time is up. In conclusion, I should like to say then that the fateful 48 hours for me are to be seen in the context of De Ecclesia, and that in many respects, the groundwork has been laid for renewal. Its actualization still lies ahead of us. Thank you very much.
As Dean Brower said, it is a matter of ending the end of chapter 1 and saying chapter 2 later. As he indicated, how will collegiality be implemented? And I'm sure he has some very definite ideas on this, at least his own thinking. And what are the consequences then for Rome, and possibly also the consequences for interfaith relations? And these are some of the things in which we would invite your questions at the informal session this afternoon at 3:30 in the student lounge, the most informal session at which you ask the questions, he gives an answer, you respond to it, a direct give and take. Again, thank you, Dean Brower, very much. We appreciate this first chapter. And the convocation is now concluded.